11 in philosophy of religion. We're going to spend a little bit of time now on the problem of evil. And a good portion of this time is going to be right out of Geisler's textbook. One of the best works on the problem of evil is the textbook we have, Philosophy of Religion. Take a look at part four, which deals with the problem of evil. There's four chapters. On page 295, it's the first of the four chapters, which is the nature of the problem of evil. Now, in the problem of evil, the first chapter is on the nature of it. Chapter after is the metaphysical problem of evil.
Write that down on the board. Find some chalk.
There's the metaphysical problem of evil. Now, metaphysics deals with the philosophy of being. So that wants to, that question is, how did being even get into, how did evil even get into existence? If there's an all good God,
does that also address, is there actually evil?
Yeah, it would ask you if evil, well, here's the way it would go, and Geisler got it spelled out real clear in the book. God had created everything. God created everything that exists. Evil exists, therefore God created evil. Now, the Bible teaches that God didn't create evil, but it seems to necessarily follow. So that's the metaphysical. Some would, in their attempt to respond to it, would deny that evil really exists. Others would deny that God is all good, or would be dualist and say there's an all good God and an all evil God.
Yeah.
And so that's the metaphysical problem. The moral problem that would deal with the fact that God, an all-powerful God, would defeat, is capable of defeating evil, and all good God would want to defeat, destroy evil, but evil exists, therefore no all-good, all-powerful God. So we try to say why God would allow evil, and we get into the man's free will and things like that. Then what Geisler calls physical evil, what I think is better called natural evil, probably the reason why he doesn't call it natural evil is because then they might think it's the nature of evil, which would really be the metaphysical problem of evil. But physical and natural evil, evil that doesn't seem to be directly related to human free will, such as earthquakes and diseases and things of that sort. And so first he's going to talk about the nature of the problem itself in chapter 14. Then chapter 15 deals with the metaphysical problem of evil. The next chapter, the moral problem. And then finally, the physical or natural problem of evil. Now there is, by the way, what some people call the religious problem of evil. I think Geisler mentions it in here. He's mentioned in some of his other works. And in, I think Plotinga mentions it in his God, Freedom, and Evil. But there is also, we're not going to spend time on it, because it's really not a philosophy subject, what I would call the personal problem of evil. Some call it the religious problem of evil, or maybe the individual problem of evil, but the personal problem of evil would be the fact that you had a loved one die at a young age, like my wife had her brother die, who was 27 years old, a tragic death. That's a personal problem of evil. They might need you, a counselor, a Christian counselor, to have some knowledge about an answer to the moral dilemma of the problem of evil, or the metaphysical dimension of the problem of evil, or the physical, whatever. But for the most part, in most cases, what is needed is a hug, and for somebody to tell them that, God loved them, and I don't understand what you're going through. So it's more of the personal problem of evil is more of a counseling type thing, than it is a philosophical thing, although some people in those counseling settings are looking for philosophical answers as well. Okay? So this one, we'll just put it in parentheses, the personal problem of evil, and we'll concentrate on the other three. But the nature of the problem of evil, page 295 there, he talks about the different dimensions of the problem of evil, the bottom of the second paragraph, last sentence, and he calls them the metaphysical, the moral, and the physical, which we talked about already. On page 297, he discusses non-theistic solutions. Christians are theists. We believe in a personal God who is immanent. He's involved with the creation. He sustains and keeps it in existence. He can perform miracles. But he is also transcendent. He is above and separate from the creation. And so these solutions would not fit a God that fits that description. These are non-theistic solutions to the problem of evil. On 297, Geisler talks about illusionism. Illusionism, which a person would dare say that nothing really is evil, that evil does not exist, it's only an illusion. And of course, the Christian would reject that. Now, Eastern religions, Buddhism and Hinduism, would hold to this. Christian Science, which is a blending of the mind of the Eastern mysticism and Christianity, would hold to that type of thing. But one of the main problems with illusionism is the fact that the fact that what seems to be most self-evidently true in our most basic common experiences would turn out to be an illusion. And if you can't trust the reality of the feeling of pain or the emotion of pain, what can you trust? And so it seems overwhelmingly true that evil does, in fact, exist. But that response, anyway, would not be open to the theist. Nor would sadism, bottom of page 298, that God would be a cosmic sadist who deliberately inflicted evil on the world because he enjoys watching other things suffer. Theism, obviously, is a belief of hope in a God who loves us, a God who's concerned about us, a good God, not an evil God that would do something like that. Finitism's answer to evil, the idea of a finite God. Before the class started, I showed you the When Bad Things Happen to Good People, written by Rabbi Harold Kushner, who holds to a finite, limited God. He causes him on the last page of his book to ask us, are you, and I'm quoting from Kushner, page 148, When Bad Things Happen to Good People, are you capable of forgiving and loving God even when you have found out that he is not perfect, even when he has let you down and disappointed you by permitting bad luck and sickness and cruelty in his world and permitting some of those things to happen to you? Can you learn to love and forgive him despite his limitations, as does Job? Again, he misunderstands Job. And as you once learned to forgive and love your parents, even though they were not as wise, as strong, or as perfect as you needed them to be. And so Rabbi Harold Kushner ends up having a God hold to this response, that evil exists because God is limited in either his power or his goodness and is not perfect, is not able to stamp out and defeat evil. So of course this is not a response that would be open to the theist. Geisler closes that section on page 300 about finitism. If there is no infinite God, there appears to be no final solution to the problem of evil. There's no guarantee that evil will be defeated without the existence of the all-powerful, all-good God of the Bible. He is the only guarantee that evil will be defeated. Just about everybody, by the way, that has any hope in life and that doesn't commit suicide lives like there's a strong possibility of evil being defeated. So that's a very strong argument that tugs at the heart. Determinism's answer to evil is also not open to the Christian. This is the idea that God had to create the kind of world that we had in. The world, Spinoza, who was a pantheist, Benedict Spinoza, he held that God necessarily created. God didn't freely choose to create, he had to create. He had no choice and he had to create the exact kind of world that we have. Now theism, God chooses. He doesn't need to create. God chose to create the kind of world that we have. So this is not open to us. We have to explain why an all good, all powerful God who could have actualized any possible world, why he actualized the possible world that he did, especially when there's so much evil in this world. Impossibilism's answer to evils on page 302, this is the idea that it's impossible for even an infinite God whose infinite knowledge to foreknow future free events. In other words, future free choices. Clark Pinnock holds to this. Many Christians are jumping on this bandwagon, Christian scholars. And Geisler, I believe, rightly argues on page 303 that God can foresee something will happen without foredetermining that it must happen. Second, the theistic God is timeless and does not foresee anything. He sees everything in one eternal now. Hence, knowledge of what men do with their freedom does not determine what they do. It merely observes what they do. Then he argues, too, there, just because an event is determined does not mean it cannot be freely chosen. That opens up a bigger debate that goes beyond the focus of this class. Geisler says in the middle part of that final paragraph on page 303, second, a man may have the ability to do otherwise even though he does not choose to do so. That has a lot to do, even though Geisler rejects Molinism, Molinists would applaud that statement. In fact, Geisler, I think, contradicts a lot of statements in his philosophical works. He contradicts in his theological works, such as when he contributed to predestination and free will. But on top of page 304, it says, God can foresee without forcing. And then he talks about God does not foresee at all. He knows what is going on in the whole course of time in one eternal now, one eternal thought. Okay, but with God's omniscience, he knows all things, and that includes, he knows all true propositions, and that includes what will happen in the year 1998, even though it hasn't occurred yet. And just because God knew that I would show up for this class tonight does not mean that I was not free to not show up for this class. In the Molinist sense, God foreknew what circumstances would have to be actualized for me to freely choose to come here, and then God predetermined that those circumstances would come about so that he predetermined that I would be here, but his predetermining, his predestination of this event does not exclude the fact that I have my free choice. That was part of the data that God was working with in the scenario of all possible worlds. Of course, Geisler wouldn't get into the Molinist kind of thing, but I think he should. I asked William Lane Craig if he would debate Geisler, and he said, Geisler was his old professor, and he doesn't think that he thinks it would fill too big of a wedge between them, but I really think that that's one debate that Craig would win. Now, there are solutions to the problem of evil open to theism. Page 304 talks about some of them. Six basic alternatives. God could have decided not to create anything at all. That was a possibility open to God. Number two, God could have created only beings who are not free. But then again, if he has a goal that he wants to fellowship with and be worshipped by beings who choose to worship him, of course he's not going to choose that. Number three on page 306, God could have created beings who are free to sin, but who never do sin. And, you know, with that type of scenario, you know, we have to decide, well, is that possible, or maybe it's impossible. Maybe it's impossible for God to do that. Maybe he'd have to stop, you know, to only create one or two people, and then just stop creating anybody else to get that kind of scenario. Then again, maybe that's not possible at all for God to do it. And then maybe if it's possible, maybe it would still not create as good a situation as had he allowed people to sin and then be saved later on. We'll talk about that a little later, because there's a big question that's coming up. Many philosophers, Christian philosophers like Leibniz, have argued that this must be, since God is all-powerful and God is all-good, he must actualize the greatest possible world. Geisler, and I agree with him, does not argue that. It does not demand that God actualize the greatest possible world. What is demanded is that God actualize the greatest possible way to achieve the greatest possible world. In other words, all this evil that's going on is not the greatest possible world, but out of this is going to come a group of people who are going to be in heaven, which is the greatest possible world, and in fellowship with God throughout all eternity, and are going to be perfected and in God's in the image of God's Son. At the same time, we're going to have learned things about God's grace. If there was no sin, there would be no need for grace. If there was no evil, there would be no reason for courage. If there was no evil, we wouldn't be able to love our enemies. We'd only be able to love our friends, because everyone would be our friends. So this is the greatest possible way to achieve the greatest possible world. It's not the greatest possible world. Heaven is the greatest possible world. Another possibility, number five, God could have created beings who were free and who would sin. And he states there, this last alternative reveals that it is possible to create beings who need not sin, but who will sin. And he states too, this latter alternative, according to theism, is that which brought about the kind of world we do live in. It is the alternative that the theistic God did choose. So what we've got to defend is why God would create a world with created beings who are free and didn't have to sin, yet who would sin. Why would God actualize such a world? That's the world that we live in, so that's what we've got to defend. So now that was the hypothetical alternatives to theism. Now we find out that the actual alternative to theism, because of what the actual world is, a world where people do sin, now we find them on pages 310 and 311. And we're discussing here the problem of evil. So the actual alternatives for theism are dictated by the kind of world that we do live in, not some kind of world that we might live in. Geisler says in point number one there on 310, the theist need not prove three things. Doesn't have to prove three things in order to answer the problem. First, he doesn't have to show that this world is literally the best of all possible worlds, but only that there could be no better, better world or non-world. I don't like the way he worded that. No better world or no better world or no better non-world. Okay, I see what he's saying there. Second, the theistic solution to evil need not demonstrate exactly how God can achieve the highest perfection out of a world with evil in it, because this may be beyond the grasp of finite being. In other words, we don't have to have the answer to every little problem and show exactly what God is doing, because if we could do that, we would be God. And so we don't have to have all the answers. Like Isaiah says in Isaiah 55:8-9, as God speaking, he says, as my ways and as the heavens are far above the earth, so are my ways and my thoughts far above yours. So we don't have to have all the answers. All we have to do is provide some possible solutions and then show that some of these possible solutions, there's some good evidence for them. In other words, they're entering into the realm of probability. The third point there, he says down at the bottom of the final sentence, proving that an evil world is definitely as good as a non-evil world is unnecessary. Establishing a probability that it is as good is a necessity for deism. We have to show that an evil world like the one we live in is probably as good as, or better, I would even say, than a non-evil world. And the reason being, you know, we could know nothing of God's grace. We could know nothing of courage. We could know nothing of loving enemies. We could know many things that we learn from mistakes and from sins that without God allowing evil, we would not have been able to experience how much God had the ability to love his creatures, because he loved not obedient creatures, but even disobedient creatures who spit in his face and turned their backs on him. He states that a theistic solution to evil must meet three conditions. First, the theist must show that his solution is at least possible. It's not contradictory or impossible. Number two, it must offer evidence to indicate that it is achievable. The theistic solution to evil. And three, it must present a way to know how it can be verified or falsified if it is or is not achieved. Okay? That, he talks later on, that's the eschatological verification, the end time verification. John Hick talks about it a little bit in his works while he's off the wall on most things, that in the end, if Jesus does come back and establish his kingdom, that if Jesus never comes back and the world ends without him, you know, that's going to falsify the view. But he Geisler says on page 311, it's not sufficient for theism to establish the mere possibility of an answer to evil. The theistic solution must be plausible. There must be some evidence to indicate that the theist solution is actually true. Evil is used as the main evidence against theism, and one cannot do away with an opponent's main evidence by simply showing that it is possible that it is not true. Let's see. On page 313, the third paragraph down there says, the dilemma seems most painful for theism. God must do his best, and yet this world he made is not the best. Is there any way out? Only one. This is not the best of all possible worlds, but it is the best of all possible ways, i.e. a necessary way, to achieve the best of all possible worlds. Again, the best of all possible worlds is heaven, where free creatures have freely chosen to spend eternity worshiping and serving their Creator, whom they love. And so this is not the best possible world, but it's the best possible way to achieve the best possible world. You know, God could have just created us already actualized in a perfect state in heaven where we would be worshiping him throughout all eternity, but in essence what he really would have done was created robots, because we never really had the freedom and we never were brought to the point where we freely decided to worship him throughout all eternity. Then he says, start of the final paragraph on page 313, the achievement of this final goal is possible only if God is infinite. Certainly nothing less than an infinitely wise and powerful God could guarantee the outcome. I think Rabbi Harold Kushner really needs to think about it. By the way, Geisler debated him, and the videos are available on John Ankerberg show, and it was the kindest I've ever seen Geisler in a debate, because Harold Kushner started his opening statement about how his 14-year-old son died in a tragic accident, and so Geisler used an awful lot of compassion. And I think when he relaxes and uses compassion, his argumentation is just, he does not need to bully people around. Like Jeff, you were telling me about one guy wrote a book about how Geisler bullied, and one of his illustrations was how Geisler bullied him around until the guy finally left Dallas Theological Seminary where Geisler was teaching at the time. Geisler had enough intellect and enough smarts to where if he would just be a little nicer with some people. There are guys that literally, if you mention Geisler's name, they laugh as if he's writing comic books. But then when you use his argumentation without his name, these guys are, these scholars are impressed and want to know who you're reading. And so if Geisler would just be a little calmer, I think people would recognize his place in history as probably the greatest evangelical Thomist alive today. The dimensions of the problem of evil for theism, he mentioned on page 314 to 317, we talked about them. Number one is the metaphysical aspect of the problem of evil. That reads like this: God is the author or the creator of everything in the world. Number two, evil is something in the world. Number three, therefore God is the author of evil. Now, Geisler asked, let me tell you something. I'm not going to do it right here because I don't want you to turn off the cassettes or go to sleep in the class. If you master pages 314 to 317, well, if you master the italicized sentence that this is not the best of all possible worlds, but is the best of all possible ways to achieve the best of all possible worlds, that on page 313, that italicized section, and then if you master pages 314 to 317, that will give you an understanding of everything that guys are going to say later on. Now, you should read and study everything else, but 10 years from now, you're probably not going to remember anything but what's on pages. If you remember what's on pages 314 and 317, you're going to have a pretty good philosophical head on your shoulders in this area. But the metaphysical aspect of the problem of evil, God is the author of evil in the world. Evil is something in the world, therefore God is the author of evil. The theist reply down there, 1, 2, and 3, and in fact, I didn't want to go over it all. I'll go over it now, and then we'll touch on them later on anyway. The theist reply to this is the whole answer to it, these three little tiny points. God is the author of everything, but evil is not a thing. It's not a substance. Conclusion, hence, God, and now on page 314, hence God is not necessarily the author, by the way, 314 of Philosophy of Religion, I don't think I ever mentioned it on the... hence God is not necessarily the author of any evil, i.e. substance. Now that sounds like he's holding to illusionism. We're going to find out that that is not the case. Evil really does exist, but not as a separate substance. Everything that God created is good, but evil exists as a real privation or a lack that should be there, an absence of some good that should be there. Okay? We're going to spend more time on that. He gets into a little bit of the teachings of Augustine and Aquinas. We'll spend some time on that real shortly. Page 315 talks about the moral aspect of the problem of evil. This goes as follows. Evil exists. An omnipotent or all-powerful God could destroy evil. A benevolent or all-good God would destroy evil. Therefore, since evil is not destroyed, then either God is all-powerful, omnipotent, and hence malevolent in some way. In other words, God is all-powerful, but he's not all-good. Or B, God is all-good, and hence impotent or not all-powerful in some way, or God is both not all-good and not all-powerful, or there is no God at all. None of those four choices is theism. So we've got to respond to this and find a problem in there. One of the responses to the moral problem, he lists right there, God is responsible for making everything in the world, including human freedom brought about moral evil in the world. Hence, God is responsible for what brought about moral evil in the world. In other words, God did not directly, God is not guilty of actualizing evil. He is guilty, if you want to call him guilty, he's guilty of creating the possibility for evil being actualized. But what is the possibility for evil being actualized? It's free will. And we all want free will, and we all know free will is a good thing. At the same time, that's where evil comes into existence, when we abuse our free will. He talks about the middle of the second paragraph on page 316. The theist can support his contention that with the possibility of evil, freedom, also comes the possibility of achieving a greater good. So God allows evil for the purpose of a greater good. But we'll spend more time on the moral argument, the moral problem of evil. The physical aspect of the problem of evil deals with physical evils or natural evils, evils that occur in nature that don't seem to be directly related with human free will. Remember the book Albert Camus, The Plague, that I showed earlier, a novel, which says that, let me see, here he argues from The Plague right here on 316, either one must join the doctor and fight the plague, or else join the priest and not fight the plague. Not to fight the plague is anti-humanitarian. To fight the plague is to fight against God who sent it, because God sent the plague. Therefore, if humanitarianism is right, theism is wrong. Now, the thing is, I think Geisler does a good job with it. I don't remember. But some of my professors at Liberty University acted like Albert Camus was arguing that because God... They think Camus arguing God sent the plague, so if we fight it, we're fighting God. And we just show, well, God didn't send the plague. We, through our own free will, fell, and therefore we can fight the plague because the plague is the enemy of God. Camus' argument is actually stronger than that. I think Geisler alludes to it. Camus' argument is that, hey, okay, he says to the Christian, I'll give you exactly what you're saying, but you still can't fight the plague. That's what Camus is saying. You say God didn't bring evil himself. He merely permitted it, and he permitted it for a greater good. So God allows evil for the purpose of a greater good. Who are you to oppose evil? Because you're stopping God's greater good from coming about. And part of the response to that is that part of the greater good that God has intended by allowing evil is to encourage godly men to stand up and to fight the plague with him, to join God and fight the plague. When you think of men like Abraham Lincoln, who fought to end slavery, that, you know, God allowed the plague of sin and the plague of things like slavery to encourage good men to take a stand and to fight against it. So part of the greater good is to cause good men to stand up against evil.
And a lot of the evil of the Civil War created a lot of greater good. Salvation Army came out of that.
Yeah. No. And then I don't want to get too far off from I could end up talking about the Civil War for the next 2 weeks, and then we'll... Okay, so now we come to chapter 15, the metaphysical problem of evil. The basic metaphysical problem right there on page 318, God is the cause, one, God is the cause of everything that exists. Two, evil is something that exists. Conclusion, therefore, God is the cause of evil. It seems like, you know, it seems like you can't even defeat that. It seems like it must necessarily be true. Now, if we decide, okay, therefore, since God is the cause of everything that exists, therefore evil does not exist, it's only an illusion, that's problematic because illusionism is a denial of theism. If the theist denies the reality of evil, he's basically given way to pantheism and the non-Christian position. I mean, Jesus Christ came to die on the cross for our sins. Sin is evil, so evil must be real. So we have to disagree with the Christian Scientists, with the Unity School of Christianity, those cults, and with the Buddhists and the Hindus who call evil an illusion. But dualism is also a denial of theism, which says that you've got an all-good God or some dualists try to have an infinitely good God and an infinitely evil God coexisting, co-eternal. Problem is, if they're both infinite, then they're not both... if they're both infinite, there could only be one of them, because one would limit the other. Therefore, you'd probably have to reduce them to two finite gods. And then the problem is, if they're finite gods, they still need an infinite cause. So all you've done is press the argument back a little further. But dualism, the idea of an all-good, eternal evil and eternal good coexisting, is problematic. Weiser says on page 320, the second full paragraph there, only an infinite God could possibly guarantee a better kind of world than the present one. If dualism is the answer, hey, if they're both eternal, they're going to be battling each other out forever. Maybe the good God's going to lose.
Maybe it'll be a draw, eternal draw.
And so if you want to join, you know, people like Rabbi Harold Kushner said, come on, let's join the battle against evil and help God, who has failed in so many ways and can't guarantee for us the defeat of evil. Why? If history shows us anything, it shows us that probably evil's going to win. Unless there's an all-good, all-powerful God who wants to destroy evil, it might be better, Rabbi Kushner, if we side up with evil. Because it looks like we'd be winners there in that area, rather than siding with the good. So the theistic answer to metaphysical dualism is that evil is not a real entity. Okay? Evil is not a real entity. Augustine on page 321, he quotes from some of the works of Augustine. Geiser is very well read in both Augustine and Aquinas. Unlike most evangelicals, who just read somebody who commented on Augustine and Aquinas. Augustine said this in his first... By the way, Augustine used to be a Manichaean, and that was basically a dualistic philosophy. He believed that was... And it was the thing that kept him from becoming a Christian was the problem of evil. And then finally he recognized the problems with dualism, and he ended up coming up with a tremendous response that to this day has not been refuted, although college professors will basically lie through their teeth and say otherwise. But he argues that all things are good because, Augustine argues, all things are good because God created them. Now I'm quoting from Geisler, who's paraphrasing Augustine. All things are good because God created them. Any corruption of these substances cannot come from the incorruptible God. And furthermore, all corruption can occur only in a good substance that is being corrupted. Okay? Point number one, every substance as such is good. Now, don't Augustine was more Calvinistic than Calvin. He's not denying the depravity of man or the fallenness of creation.
Just a corruption of a previously perfect thing.
Yeah, but even though the thing was previously perfect, the thing still is good.
Right, just not perfect.
But the fact is, it's not as good as it should be. Yeah, what you're saying is exactly right. But I'm trying to look at it from. I'm just trying to emphasize the point that there's a corruption of that perfect.
So it's
perfect
better.
Yeah. Still a good apple, but it's got a lot of wounds.
Yeah, and it's in fact, worms, you brought up that parasites is the way that they're going to be. It's like a parasite must live off something else. Evil is like rust in an automobile. Rust has to exist on the metal. Before a line can be made crooked, it had to be straight in the first place. And so, evil is a perversion or a corruption of that which is good. Let me see. Okay, so he argues every substance as such is good because God is the creator of all being. Everything God creates is good like himself. Hence, everything that exists is good. This is perfectly in line with Genesis 1:31. God looked at everything he created and said that everything is good. Let me see. Let's skip to the point 4 on page 322. Augustine argued that evil is not a substance. Now Geisler quotes from Augustine. For evil has no positive nature. God did not create evil beings. Somebody might say, what about Satan? No, he was Lucifer. He was God's greatest creation at the time. He was not an evil being. But then he abused the free will that God gave him, and that brought evil into him as rust comes to a car. He perverted the nature that God had created him to be. But for evil has no positive nature, but the loss of good has received the name evil. Evil is not a substance, for if it were a substance, it would be good. Since evil lacks any nature of its own, it is not a substance, but a privation of the substance of another. Now, let me say this. Privation is not equivalent to absence. Privation does not equal absence or lack. Okay? What privation is equal to is the absence of something that should be there or the lack of something that should be there. Okay?
So,
it's like this. If you got a rock, this is a classic illustration. It is, if a rock cannot see, that is not evil. Rocks were not designed, so the absence of sight in a rock is not evil. The lack of sight in a rock is not evil. But the lack or absence of sight in a human being, that is evil. Now, I'm not saying that particular person caused it by their own sin, the health, wealth, and prosperity doctrine. But what I'm saying is God designed human beings to see. And the fact that a human being cannot see means that this must be a fallen creation. Evil must have entered into it. So a privation is an absence or a lack of something that should be there. Humans should be able to see. Rocks do not have that ability. So evil is not a substance, point 4. Point 5 on page 322, evil is a corruption of a substance. Augustine says, if it must first be inquired, wrote Augustine, what is evil, which is nothing else than corruption. Either of the measure of, or the form or the order that belongs to nature. So evil is not a substance, it's not a created substance, but it's a corruption of that created substance.